Hello and welcome to Worlds Apart. Great powers have always watched each other with a tinge of jealousy and hostility, but is it inevitable? With China's recent diplomacy breaking a number of long-held geopolitical assumptions, can it pave the way for a world where great means not only might is right, but also responsibility that comes with power? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Talmis Ahmad, India's former ambassador to Saudi Arabia. Ambassador, it's a great pleasure, a great honor for me to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
You know, whenever I interview prominent Indian thinkers on China, I always feel myself a part of a love-hate triangle because China and India are so big and so close geographically that I guess it's impossible for them to be neutral towards each other. Having said that, I wonder if China's recent breakthrough diplomacy, including the success in bringing the Saudis and the Iranians to the negotiating table, is that worthy of respect and particularly worthy of respect of their Indian counterparts?
I think it is worthy of respect from the Indian side. Any initiative, any diplomatic initiative that promotes peace and stability in the Middle East is to be welcomed by all of us. And I see no difficulty in welcoming whatever has been achieved in Beijing in bringing together Saudi Arabia and Iran. The two countries have been estranged for far too long. There has been a lot of vituperation exchanged between them. They nearly came to conflict, a war, in a set of circumstances in 2019. So I personally welcome this initiative, and I hope that that with Chinese support, the two countries will be able to go forward and will be able to successfully address the various matters that divide them.
Now, one of the reasons why I think the news of the Saudi-Iranian deal astonished many is that we have come to take this rift for granted as almost the natural rather than man-made state of international affairs. How much do you think geopolitics, and by that I mean this fluid mix of various interests and various influences, how much has it influenced the initial rift and how much has it influenced its apparent resolution now?
I don't accept the idea that there is any inevitability in international relations, nor do I believe that there has been any inevitability with regard to the estrangement between Saudi Arabia and Iran. There have been long periods when revolutionary Iran and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia actually had very good relations. After the Iran-Iraq war, you had President Rafsanjani visiting Riyadh, and they were able to sign a very major agreement. And it was an extremely warm visit. After that, there have been issues that divided them, not necessarily connected with anything that had happened between them, but a sense of strategic vulnerability, I would call it, in Riyadh after the events of the Arab Spring. Saudi Arabia had been wary to a considerable extent about its northern neighbor, which was so much bigger and had such a large population and considerable defense capability. So it was concerned, but it was also conscious of the fact that it could hold its own because of the affiliation with the Americans. The Americans were supposed to be security guarantors as far as the kingdom was concerned. But the situation deteriorated. There were proxy conflicts in Syria and in Yemen that divided them, and there was a sense of zero-sum scenario. What changed the situation fundamentally was the growing realization in Riyadh that the Americans are not credible security providers. And it is for this reason that for the last few years, the Saudis have been looking at other diplomatic options. And they have been talking to the Iranians already from 2021, 2022, they had five rounds of meetings in Baghdad and in Muscat. And I would see the Chinese initiative in this background. So I would say that, yes, this is a very positive development. It is the culmination of certain compulsions on both sides, certainly. But at the same time, it also recognizes that China has now proclaimed that it is going to be a significant political and diplomatic presence in the region.
Let me ask you specifically about China's role here. And I heard you say before that China recognizes its limits. It understands that problems can only be addressed and hopefully resolved by the countries themselves, but it's ready to provide what psychologists call a safe container, or what you call a quasi-mediation, this sort of congenial, authentic atmosphere that where those difficult issues could be tackled or at least discussed. Now, how important it is, and are there any other countries or any other platforms that can provide this safe space for genuine, authentic negotiation of difficult issues?
The background relating to China is that there has been a rise of China in regional and world affairs over the last 40 years. The first 20 years, the rise was low-key. It did not proclaim that it was making progress, and it was concerned that if the Western powers came to know about it, they would do anything to jeopardize it and obstruct it. The first proclamation, largely of an economic character, about the emergence of China on the world stage occurred exactly 10 years ago. In 2013, President Xi Jinping announced the One Belt, One Road initiative that later became the Belt and Road Initiative. 10 years later, China has announced that it is also going to be a major political player in world affairs. It had shied away from this. China believed that it was not familiar with West Asia, had not been there for a long time, did not know the religion, the language, and the culture. But the last 10 years, I have noticed that Chinese scholars have built up extraordinary expertise with regard to the region. And they are China, therefore, is much more confident. The Chinese approach is quite different from that of the Americans. The American approach is to have a very strong military presence in the region and to have friends and enemies and to constantly intervene in political matters through military force. I would say to you very frankly that over the last 40 years, since the end of the Cold War, I would say to you that the United States has left the region totally shattered. What the Chinese offer is something quite different. They call it quasi-mediation policy. Quasi-mediation policy means that we can't solve your problems. Problems can be solved by countries only through engagement with each other. What the Chinese do is offer their good offices and then, in a sense, encourage dialogue and harmony. They use the word harmony in this regard. They're not solving problems. They are encouraging dialogue between people and standing by. If you recall here that this agreement is not a bilateral agreement, it is a trilateral agreement, which means that the Chinese have made themselves an integral part of this agreement and therefore have made themselves guarantors of its success.
Clearly, China's reputation as a peace builder or as a mediator has received a significant boost, but there are also some provisions, economic provisions in this deal. For example, Beijing is trying to encourage Saudi Arabia and Iran to conduct any bilateral trade deals being denominated in yuan. If that comes to pass, what do you think is going to be the significance of that, both for the three countries involved and perhaps even broader?
That is at still at a nascent stage, and it has some way to go. I have already seen a number of reports from various sources indicating an increasing attraction or using yuan or any other non-dollar barter transactions, if it comes to that, in order to facilitate trade. Because the United States is believed to have misused the power of the dollar. The unilateral sanctions imposed upon Iran, the unilateral withdrawal from the nuclear agreement, and the crippling sanctions imposed, which impoverished that country, it is seen as a gross misuse of the dollar. If you have sanctions, I would say to you very frankly, a country can impose sanctions. But what the Americans did, taking advantage of its financial status globally, it made it compulsory for the rest of the international community to participate in these sanctions. And that has disenchanted the international community. Large numbers of leaders in West Asia, as well as in other parts of Asia, are seriously concerned that if this kind of unilateral and grossly unfair action can be taken against Iran, or against Venezuela, or against any other country,
or against Russia, for example, let's not miss the elephant in the room as well.
And against Russia. So countries are concerned. And you can already see that the Chinese buy a lot of Iranian oil. India has substantial ties with the Russians on the basis, despite the sanctions. And Iran and India are likely to build up or rebuild economic ties on this basis. So countries that have been unfairly targeted by the Americans only on account of its financial clout are likely to look for other options.
Now, Ambassador, I don't know if you would agree with that, but I think the Americans tend to view these defiance of their universal policy as an ideological move. They like to portray it as a sort of a battle, existential battle between democracy and autocracies. But from what you're saying, the countries are doing that not out of any ideological reason per se, but they're simply pursuing the commonsensical, if not survivalist, interest. Do I understand you correctly that it's not so much an act of defying the Americans as simply following your own path and doing what's good for you without necessarily trying to steal something from others?
With all respect to the American policymakers in Washington, D.C., this business of authoritarian versus democratic carries no conviction whatsoever. Nobody in the world believes in it. For the Americans, are you with us or are you against us? That is the credo. It doesn't matter who you are. You will remember that in their time, the Americans have been the strongest supporters of apartheid, South Africa, authoritarian regimes in Latin America and Africa, authoritarian regimes in Asia. So I am not impressed with this. And it is worthy of considerable pejorative description. What we are looking for, therefore, and as you know, neither China nor Russia nor India, nor Iran, or anyone buys this argument of a binary, of a new Cold War. What we have been agitating over the last 20 years or so is that we are looking at a multipolar world order. That's all we are saying. We are simply saying it is not an anti-American posture. What we are saying is a large number of countries have emerged on the world stage. They have their own interests and prerogatives and priorities. They want to retain the option of taking their own foreign policy posture where specific issues are concerned. You will see in the context of the war in Ukraine, hardly any country has supported the American agenda of democracy versus authoritarianism or words to that effect. Because the world believes we are a multipolar world. We have a right to take our own decisions in regard to matters domestic as well as matters regional and international.
Okay, well, Ambassador, we have the right and obligation right now to take a little break, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Talmis Ahmad, India's former ambassador to Saudi Arabia. Ambassador, before the break, we were talking about how various countries finally have the resolve and perhaps the necessity to pursue their own national interest and the concept of multipolar world, not as a necessarily ideological defiance to the United States, but simply out of their own interest. And I heard you say before that the US's answer to that changing world order has been a new Cold War, which I have to say in Ukraine turned into a hot war. Do you think that will help the Americans to hold on to their so-called leadership? And I'm not asking for a moral judgment here. Do you think that's a good strategic decision to pursue a confrontation with Russia as a way of sort of holding on to their the benefits that they have been sustaining?
The days of Western control, Western-led world order, and the days of U.S. hegemony are over. That world order is now done with. What you are seeing in Ukraine is the last attempt, desperate attempt, by the Americans and a few Western allies that they have, who are desperately trying to retain that old order. It's a moth-eaten order that has no relation with reality. The world has changed. I want to make 2 points in this regard. Number one, during that short period, the Americans were the sole superpower in the world. Look at the extraordinary violence and damage that they inflicted. Their own, we are today looking at 20 years after the Iraq war. We also know that very recently, the damage that the Americans did in Afghanistan. We are told officially that 500,000 people were killed during the American occupation of the two countries in Afghanistan and Iraq. Now, that is the reason why. That is one part. The second is, there has been a rise of other countries. They are not claiming superpower status, but they are carrying a certain degree of influence and are seeking arrangements that would recognize these changes. Therefore, to put it very bluntly to you, that old world order is passé. And that is where we have to go. Can the multipolar world be halted? It cannot be. It's already a reality. Look at the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and BRICS and the Indian Ocean Rim Association and numerous other entities, none of them dominated by Western powers, each of them flourishing on its own dynamics on the basis of its own logic. I'm going to make one more point, and that is rather provocative. And that is this. For the time being, certain West European countries have bought into the American agenda. But is that sustainable? What has happened is, remarkably, taking advantage of the war in Ukraine, Germany is rearming with hundreds of billions of dollars. Would the world have accepted this in any other set of circumstances? Point one. Point two, can you imagine a rearmed Germany becoming subordinate to the American agenda in, say, 5 or 10 years' time? Can you imagine France remaining subordinate to the American agenda? Perhaps Japan will for some time because of its insecurity vis-a-vis China. But look at Korea. Korea is not willing to join the Western alliance against China as of now. Therefore, I'm suggesting to you that what you see as even this core group around the Americans, I believe that arrangement is also inherently fragile and is not sustainable.
Can I ask you about that? Because this is something that is being discussed in Russian circles a lot, namely what you mentioned, whether we can imagine a rearmed Germany or France remain under the American control or the American command for the next 5 to 7 years. But if we look at the national elites of those countries, most of them are Western educated. Their level of expertise or their level of knowledge, even of the basic European history, seems to be very, very limited. What makes you believe that something will happen in those great European nations that will provide the kind of leads that will be more, if not more assertive against the Americans, but then at least a little bit more independent and minding their own interests?
It's a difficult question for me to answer without causing offense. I have, as a long diplomatic career of 37 years, I have been appalled at the extent of ignorance in Western countries, particularly in Western Europe and the United States, with regard to the history, the culture, and the dynamics, the political dynamics of countries in Africa and Asia and Latin America. Even many of their so-called experts, they are so inward-looking, they are so quote-unquote nationalistic, that they fail to see that the essential requirement of diplomacy as well as of objective commentary is that you must know where your interlocutor is coming from. You must know what is agitating him or her. They must know what are their priorities and interests. You are so consumed with your own interests, your own priorities, you have convinced yourself, particularly the Americans, have convinced themselves that they are exceptional. They are unique people in the world. They are a force for good. Every American believes that. Most Americans believe that. But all of us know in Asia and Africa and Latin America that it is completely false. So, yes, we have a problem of knowledge. It is not something that you can correct over time. People are inward looking, and you have small elites who are looking only at their own interests. The pandemic has made people even more inward looking and more self-centered, more worried about their future. And therefore, yes, there is a certain turbulence and uncertainty in the regional order and the world order. And that is what we are living through. We are living through that. We are living through a churn of uncertainty.
I want to ask you a specific question about energy, and not so much energy, but rather Saudi Arabia, and utilize your enormous expertise in that area. Isn't it even more striking than China's recent success, the Saudis' intention to and resolve to go their own way? Because for many years, the Saudis positioned themselves as a staunch American ally. And yet, if we actually look at the recent statements and their recent moves, for example, their commitment to the APEC plus deal, their refusal to sell oil to countries that introduce price caps on oil, including, that's the measure that is pushed by the West. You know, it seems that their foreign policy is far more independent and far more actually inward looking than any of the countries that, surround the West at this point of time.
Absolutely right. You know, events in our part of the world came as a surprise to Western commentators because they don't follow the in-depth logic. It's not a surprise for us. We live here. I have watched Saudi Arabia evolve over a period of time. Yes, they thought themselves vulnerable. They had a small population of about 20 million plus 10 million foreigners. They did not have a very strong military tradition. They bought American weapons but had no intention of using them. But you started seeing their change. They attempted to engage with Donald Trump. Donald Trump's presidency accelerated the disenchantment in West Asia with regard to the Americans being seen as security providers. Obama had started the process already. Some of the loose remarks, pivot to Asia. It was one of the most idiotic remarks I had heard, because if you are going to confront China, you don't need to go to where China is. You need to go to where China carries influence. So you can't go to the South China Sea to pivot to Asia. This is where they are. But what the West Asians read it as, their abandonment. That was the beginning. The second was the nuclear agreement with the Iranians, at a time when the region was agitated about Iranian concerns relating to Iran. Here was Obama negotiating a nuclear agreement without consulting any of them. The third was the period of Donald Trump, when there was a standoff between the US and Iran, sanctions on the Iranians, and that attack, that proxy attack on the oil facilities. All of these, and then the final straw, was the ignominious American withdrawal from Afghanistan, from Kabul, which we saw, and which reminded us of how they had packed and run from Vietnam all those years ago. The same pattern of abandoning your allies, packing up in a hurry, and then running away as fast as you can. The region read the lesson very well, and they realized that now a new world order has come. We cannot depend on the Americans as security providers or guarantors. We need to look elsewhere. They are not looking for security providers. The region itself has come of age. So there is no reason to be surprised. The only people surprised are those in Washington, D.C. and possibly Paris and Berlin. There's no reason. We have been watching this happen for such a long time, the sense of betrayal and the sense of letdown.
But Ambassador, maybe there's also a very inspiring message in all of that. First of all, the fact that it's not only the Americans, but any other country in the world that has a sense of its own manifest destiny and the right to pursue it on its own terms and in a friendly relationship with the others. And the second good news is that credibility is not something that comes as a birthright. You actually have to earn it. You actually have to treat others as you yourself want to be treated. And I think that's the basis of all major philosophical and religious schools.
Madam, when you speak of manifest destiny, it reminds us of the great horror of colonialism and imperialism. They carried the white man's burden. Look at the mass murders and genocide that they carried out in the name of civilization. The wiping out of the entire Red Indian community, the American Indian community, then the wiping, then the institutionalization of slavery, the domination of almost all of Asia and Africa, the brutal occupation during colonialism, and we talk of civilization and manifest destiny. That is not acceptable. That is absolute nonsense. And we should not, none of us has experienced that. It is a matter. It rouses our worst passions when you speak of their civilizing mission. We were civilized 5,000 years before any of them saw civilization. Therefore, in Asia and Africa, we are particularly angry and perturbed when we hear of these people as a result of Renaissance and like so-called enlightenment speak of the civilizing mission vis-a-vis us. Most of their civilizing mission has meant mass murder.
Absolutely. And, you know, I once interviewed former Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan, and he said that, one of the worst vestiges of colonialism is that nations start to believe that colonial narratives themselves. And I think in a sense, what we've been discussing today is that many of those countries are finally ready to free themselves from all those narratives and to recognize that there's something inherently good and valuable and cherishable in their own history, in their own national path, and indeed in their own manifest destiny, because, you know, all the nations in the world have something special, something unique to offer if the international environment supports that. Unfortunately, we have to end it here. I'm, as I said, greatly honored and greatly inspired by this conversation. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure for me.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again next week on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.